see if you get an echo.
Hello, and welcome to another in our occasional series of podcasts from Grunty Fennery, home of all things Grunty Fen. On the 2nd of September, Mr. South gave a talk to Warboys Local History Society about Dennis and Grunty Fen. The meeting was held in Warboys Methodist Church, and we managed to record it by slipping a mobile phone under Mr. South's chair. This inevitably affects the sound quality, for which we apologise. Please be aware that this recording, at times, contains language which some people may find offensive. So, without further ado, take it away, Mr. South.
It's very nice to be back in Warboys. Very nice to be here, it really is. It's one of the villages, the second favourite village in Cambridgeshire. Sorry, after Ramsey. Sorry, all right.
Is that a village?
Yeah. I believe in upsetting people, and if you do turn out rough, I'm armed. I'm not going to stand up the whole time because I'm not very good at standing up these days. Just to start with, hands up those of you who ever actually listened to Dennis on the radio. It's about a half to tip the half. Just about half, yeah. Because populations come and go and ages have got something to do with it. I want to tell you a bit about how it began and what it is and was. But first of all, to give you an idea of the sort of strength it had, this little comedy programme on quite a small radio station. The time of the outbreak of the second war in Iraq, a young American officer, he was a lawyer working for the American Air Force at Leighton Heath, was given an hour to pack to go to Iraq. And he only had a small kit bag, it was a really small thing. And so he packed everything that he wanted to take to the desert. And he included a Dennis of Grunty Fen cassette recording, because that was the thing that most sort of kept him happy in times of trouble. And when he was in a tent in the desert, he got a whole lot of other American airmen into the tent, and he had a Dennis of Grunty Fen concert, which is ridiculous, in the desert, isn't it? That gives you some idea of the appeal to different sorts of people, I guess. And another thing I can remember very early on, to give you some idea of the spread of Dennis of Grunty Fen, I got lots of reports of people leaving their homes on a Sunday morning when Dennis of Grunty Fen was being broadcast, because they didn't get very good reception where they were. These sort of far-flung places, like Warboys now. And they used to get into their cars. I'm not kidding, this is true. And they used to drive until the signal got better, and then park at the side of the road and listen to Dennis of Grunty Fen on the car radio. So that it really did reach all sorts. And one of our greatest fans was a surgeon at the hospital at Addenbrookes, because we had an episode called Singing in the Drain, which he thought was one of the best things he'd ever heard. And then we got 8-year-old boys who liked the sort of squalor of it, you know. So it was a great appeal. And essentially, for those of you who've never heard it, it was just two people talking. I represented the respectability, logic, decency, cleanliness. And he represented stupidity, pig-headedness, dirt, laziness, idleness. But the point is that we did this together for 17 years, every Sunday apart from the summer break. So, and in every single case where he and I were arguing, he always won. Now, the reason for that was that both Pete Sayers, who played Dennis of Grunty Fen, and I seriously at heart believe that the country is best, and that the countryside and country people are best. I've been born in a village and live in a village, and I don't really like towns. I don't like cities even less. He and I were a similar persuasion on that. And so we got on very well at poking fun at the pretensions of city folk. That was one of the few things we had in common. I don't really understand quite how we ever really tolerated one another, because we were so different. He was a professional musician, a singer and a songwriter. I hated his music. I mean, I really couldn't abide in this sort of fake American folk stuff. That was absolutely rubbish. And he didn't like anything. He disapproved of almost anything I liked. The one redeeming feature is he had an absolutely identical sense of humour. But otherwise, I mean, he had been a musician all his life. His father was a music teacher. He came from a rather divided and unhappy family. But he was just totally devoted to entertaining and music. And I had been in newspapers and radio ever since I was 17. And I was news editor of the Cambridge Evening News for how long? About 12 years. That's my minder. I've been writing a daily column for the evening paper for years and years, and then I went over to radio in the stupid belief that it was more likely to endure in provincial journalism than the newspaper. Well, the newspaper became rubbish, and then the radio became rubbish too, so I dust out on that one. Mm-hmm. Anyway, when I went over to radio, one of the things I used to do was go out to towns and villages with a microphone and just talk to people. And on one occasion, they sent me to the Jubilee Hall, or Memorial Hall at Newmarket, where there was an auction of antiquities and rubbish. And I just had to talk to people there. And while I was in an interval, I was just sitting there with the microphone switched off. No, it wasn't. It was live. It was live. And this awful person came and sat next to me. Filthy Mac. Black. Corduroy cap that was too big for him and came right down. He'd got glasses that were about half an inch thick. He got buck teeth. And there were badges all over this man. And he became very familiar. And so while I was trying to talk to the audience on the radio, he kept interrupting and saying things like, "You're a funny old boy," and "I like Beyond the Wireless," and he kept interrupting me and arguing with me and disagreeing. I hate being disagreed with. I've got to watch it. It was after about 5 minutes, 6 minutes, I suddenly tumbled that this wasn't a filthy, interfering, rude old man. This was a young man pretending to be a filthy, interfering rude. So I managed to sort of change gear, accommodate myself to this, and had a serious conversation with this idiot, and he played up to it. And I can't remember what we talked about, but for about 5 minutes on live radio, without the audience knowing that he was a fraud, we had this conversation between me, you know, a city slicker, how interesting, and him being very, very common and stupid. And we got away with it. Well, at the end of the programme, I sort of just packed up and went back to the studio, and that was the end of it, I thought. But then, about a fortnight later, I was walking down the corridor at the BBC, just outside the studios, when this rather well-dressed man, about my age, looking a bit show busy, but anyway, okay, he came up and said, I'm Pete Sayers. I am the chap that you had the conversation with. I just remembered he actually played the violin during on the bit. I've just forgotten that bit. And he said, how would you like to do it on the radio all the time, talking like that? Well, I don't know why. I made a resolution when I was very young, when I was almost just hatched, that I was going to say, my policy, generally speaking, and it still is to say yes to anything, just in case something really good gets its way. I'll get into terrible trouble. Some of my yeses I regret. But on the whole, I think it's a good policy. So he wanted to do a radio. He said, I've been looking for years for somebody who could be the straight man for Dennis, the awful man, on the radio. And I said, yes, and that's how it began. And we did it for 17 years, with just a little break. At this point, I will just take the story back about 20 years, the bit that I wasn't involved in at all. But Pete Sayers and his wife, Elizabeth, lived in a little village just outside Newmarket. They lived in a cottage that was a semi. Next door there was a real old Suffolk countryman. And he had a sort of, he always used to have a cap pulled down over his face and tumble down clothes. He was a real old Suffolk farm boy. And one day, Pete, who was in the entertainment business then, found a filthy old Mac in the garden shed, put it on, put a dirty cap on. I think he found some fake old glasses from somewhere. Anyway, and he went out from his house and he met the man, his next door neighbour, who had been his neighbour for 2 or 3 years. They knew one another well. And the point of the story is that the neighbour didn't recognise him because he pretended to be an old Suffolk or Cambridgeshire person. And the old boy just didn't spot that it was a neighbour. And when Pete went back into the house, Elizabeth said, there's your pension. She spotted the value. Now, in fact, neither Pete nor I really made any money out of Dennis and Grundy Fenn. I did it because for one of the best reasons in the world of doing anything is I enjoyed it. And I've been very lucky, and I hope some of you have the same luck, of doing what you enjoy doing rather than you have to do in order to survive. I've never really done anything that I didn't like doing. And even if I wasn't good at it, I still carried on. That's been good policy. Anyway, so, for some reason, the BBC, which was then an infinitely better organisation, unlike the BBC now, the then manager of Cambridge, grasped the idea immediately. And within a fortnight, we started doing the broadcast. We learned a lot. We made some terrible mistakes. To begin with, we ad-libbed the whole thing, thinking it would be more convincing. And that was a mistake. And we started to script it. And that was much more logical, and it moved along better. And the scripting was fascinating to me, because I've never, ever in my life written a script. And he'd never in his life worked off a script. And there's a lot to learn. I'm going to sit down. So much to learn about writing scripts. And we did it using the poor radio audience as they had to suffer our errors. It was a joy. Pete and I met at our house twice a week in the mornings, Tuesday and Thursday, in preparation for the Sunday broadcast. And while the rest of the world was digging holes in the road and writing boring accounts in offices and so on. We were sitting in our kitchen laughing at our own jokes so much that we were in tears. I used to get stomachache from just the laughing too much. Can you hear at the back, incidentally? No, it doesn't really matter. You haven't missed much. But I thought, how lucky I am. The first part of my life, I was very diligent, you know, good journalist, worked hard, years and years. And suddenly, all this seriousness fell away. I met this bloke with the one thing in common, same sense of humour. And on the Tuesday morning, round about 10 o'clock, he'd arrived. Janet was working in London then, so she didn't interfere or contribute.
Somebody had to earn the money.
Somebody had to earn the money. Why don't I keep my trap shut? And what are we going to do this week? What's it going to be about? Well, one of our abiding dislikes was pretentious people in little villages who want to be grand and terribly middle class and above everybody else. So we invented this character called Mrs. Jeffries. Anybody remember Mrs. Jeffries? Oh, gosh. And she was everything we hated about interfering pretentious people. And so we might have a Mrs. Jeffries week, or we might have a week about cycling. And he would make notes and give me the notes at the end. He would write down what we'd said. His writing was quite good. And then on the Thursday, we used to write it up. And I think that real professional script writers would have disapproved, or we didn't do it very well, but we understood it well enough. One of the knacks you learn is how you've got to write to length, and it's very difficult to do that. We got used to the idea of having to write about 14 and a half minutes worth of script, and sometimes I got carried away and was doing the conversation between us, typing it all up, and I got us into some ridiculous situation involving a puncture at midnight at a crossroads with a piece of antique furniture strapped to the back of his bike and rats running across in front of him. You know, the whole thing was preposterous. And then I'd turn to him and I'd say, "So what does Dennis say now?" He knew. He was Dennis. He entered the person of Dennis, the awful person, and he always knew what Dennis would say to any situation, however awful and unbelievable it was. It was normally something quite hard-hearted, because Dennis wasn't very kind, really. And so if somebody had got themselves in an awful fix in our story, and he'd say, and I'd say, "Well, what would Dennis say to this poor woman who's got into this terrible trouble?" And he'd say, she should have thought of that before she started, or something equally hard, you know, equally hard-hearted. I just thank the Lord that we had such a good time, and the whole thing got more and more popular. I mean, it's just it sounds a bit vain to say it, but a lot of people had this crazy idea that I played both parts, and they thought I was Dennis and Mr. South. But I could never get it. He would not come once he was in character, especially when he was wearing a costume. He would not come out. I was telling somebody earlier here about his refusal to come out of character. And on one occasion, we were doing a broadcast from the East of England show at Peterborough. And it was one of the things I was supposed to be doing was going into the hound show, all the local hunts had come together to, in a hand show. And I wanted to go in and speak to the MFHs and so on. And we approached, this is a time you'll remember, it's even much more less acute now, but the feeling against blood sports, it was very, very contentious, and the whole thing was very nervous. And when we approached the gate, the Hunt people had hired some very heavy guards, huge fellows in hard hats, and they wouldn't let us in because Dennis was an obvious troublemaker, this awful person. And I went up to the guards and said, "It's an actor. He's an actor." And they wouldn't believe me. Mm-hmm. And Pete wouldn't come out. Suddenly stayed at it. And in fact, he even started saying, "Well, why don't you let me out? I don't like the look of you." He was actually making it worse. He could be, as Dennis, Pete could be really nasty to people. Because there was an element of Dennis that was really hard-hearted. And he used to go up to women at country shows and say, as I mentioned this to somebody this evening, I think, you used to go up to some poor woman and say, "Who did your hair? The council?" Really? And he got away with it. Never ever came out of character. So I did. I had a jolly good time, and it went on for years and years, and it got bigger and bigger. And I think it had the sort of legs that could have gone much further. But at that time, comedy nationally was pretty well buttoned up by the footlights, the university entertainers, you know, the Cambridge and Oxford and other university young people. And I mean, they were very good. But they didn't give you what the people wanted, which was a belly laugh, or they didn't go into the nervous sort of bits of small town life and that sort of thing. They were all rather grand. But the BBC was totally committed to, I tried to get Dennis Grundy-Fenn a wider audience, and they just wouldn't have it because, oh, this is dreadful country people. You know, we've got the footlights coming. They were very amusing young men and awfully highly qualified. They've all got degrees. Well, they were funny. They were good. They're still there. But there's something to be said for down-market silliness and the sort of sometimes rather crude jokes that we went in for. And also our fantasy. I mean, we invented people and villages. Oh, we did enjoy ourselves. I mean, those of you who have heard it might have sensed how much we enjoyed ourselves. Yeah. We had a cast of, one time, I think we had about 80 characters who all turned up from time to time. The absolute biggest character at all was Dennis's granny. Very early on, they lived in a railway carriage together, very early on, we said on air that Granny was 91, and then about a month later, it turned up again, and we by mistake said she was 92, and lots of people phoned in and wrote in and said, well, she'd actually gone back, you know, she'd gone from 92 to 91, that was it. As people said, you know, how is this possible? And I said to Pete, what are we going to say? He said, tell them she lies about her age. Oh, goodness me. But such characters that were on the edge of true. Mrs. Jeffries, I mean, she didn't. She exists. I bet you've got some Mrs. Jeffries in War Poets. Might be one here tonight. I like, but I've got a busy. the vicar, who was so intimidated by his own congregation that he was always going on retreats, he didn't dare face the awful people. There were some things about our invention of Brandy Fair that were so fantastic that we thought we'd gone too far. There were three of the things, I can remember, that we invented, and we thought, that's ridiculous, we won't do that. And Pete said, oh, go on, let's do it. So one was, in some parts of Granty Fen, the ditches altered, and streams altered direction of flow, so that one week they were flowing one way. We organised an event at Ely about 8 or 9 years ago, which was organised by the Mike Petty, the who used to keep the Cambridgeshire Collection, you know, as historians you would know that. And the purpose of the meeting that Mike organised was to find out which bits of Granty Fen are true. And somebody from the water board stood up and said, at Granty Fen, the ditches can reverse direction. And I said, it's ridiculous. Ridiculous. Another one we invented was that in antiquity, and right up to about the 17th or 18th century, Granty Fen did not exist as a Church of England parish. That the parochial system excluded Granty Fen. It was on a sort of triangle. And the Church of England did not recognise it as being part of the bits they were supposed to be preaching to. It was true. It really was true that Granty Fen got left out of the episcopal map. There were other ones. Oh, and another, we had one so ridiculous. There was, according to our story, it was midnight. An old boy was cycling across the fen on a little narrow fen road, and suddenly a herd of rats came out from one side, swept across the road, got caught in the spokes of his front wheel, so that he was thrown off into the road. Somebody from the city. That really happened. It made life very difficult, you know, that almost difficult, impossible to tell lies. Now, of course, I love lying, but you do have to remember. You have to have a very good memory, don't you, if you're a liar? Yeah, I shouldn't have said that in a Methodist chapel. But anyway, I've rambled quite a lot. And I hope it's been of some interest to you. But those of you who have or haven't heard Dennis might have some questions. And I'll do my best to answer. If I don't know the answer, I'll just make it up. I'll just tell lies. But has anybody got a question like, why don't you shut up and go home? Or something like that. Anyway. So.
Are the recordings still available online, or...?
They're available on the table. I might say that they're presided over by Carol Carney. And that's the lady there who just waved her hand. And I want to tell you about her, because...
Are you sure?
Yeah, it's nice. It's all right. Sit down by yourself. But we had a series of people. When we recorded, Pete sat with one microphone, me with another, and somebody else drove the desk, as the saying is. They controlled the mics. And most of them had no idea what we were at. They had no interest at all. And so we never really got any sort of what you might call production. We had to do everything ourselves. And then we were so desperate to find somebody who was prepared to the drudgery of driving these two awful old men making their program, that they gave it to Carol. And that was a dream. And if you look at, it's difficult to spot it as an outsider, but there's a whole succession of CDs going through the years. And I can spot when Carol took over. And the last four, the ones with the voiceover thing, how many? That's two records, isn't it?
No, there's one set
of last episodes. Right. Yeah, so there's a lot of episodes that are all on one CD.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway, that was when... See, Carol is a novelist. She's got some imagination. And she saw, uniquely of the BBC people that we were surrounded by, she realised what it was about. And she started doing a bit of production and making suggestions and being useful. And Peter was dying. And I'll give you another chance to ask some questions in a minute. That we made, the last series we ever made was based on the notion that snooty, posh Mr. South had all his life been trying to get into the voiceover business on television advertisements and that sort of thing, you know. He was very proud of his voice and he really wanted to make it best. And to his absolute fury, somebody had heard Dennis and was using him to make advertisements. And Mr. South was mortified. Carol had a lot to do with that last series. And what were some of the products? There was a butter product called Moo. And we discovered afterwards that there was actually a sort of margarine called Moo. We got away with that. I will answer a question in a minute, but I've just thought of something else I wanted to tell you. That we used to go, I know we're in a chapel, and this is a tiny bit risque, but it went out in the BBC. In one episode, I was sitting in the little parlour in the railway carriage with Dennis. This is in the episode. And we were sitting by the range, and Dennis was trying to get the fire to burn, and he couldn't get it to go. But he said, "Pass me that thing," and it was a little leather poof, you know, the little low thing. And he said that I could get a bit of stuffing out of that, and it was. Do you remember this word? It was disgraceful. And he said, "You throw that on the fire." I can't hear his voice. And that makes the fire up. And he said, "There's nothing like the stuffing from a poof to get your to get your faggots going." And we thought, "Oh my God, we're in trouble." We went out on the air. And we said, "Away." So we did it again. Another episode we have is nothing like stuffing from a poof to get your faggots going. And nobody said, "Away." So I've done it again. I hope I haven't offended somebody. It's all leaving up. All right, back to questions, if any.
Did you have very many complaints come in at all?
Very few. Oh, there were, at one time the church was a bit upset, but we never really, they didn't have the courage to actually say anything. Church House Westminster asked for a set of recordings, and clearly somebody had complained, and they wanted to know what they were complaining about. So we sent them off, and we never heard another word. But because we did, we did take the church for a bit of a ride. Because Granty Fen had many chapels and churches, and the little village of Pious End had more chapels than population. And just occasionally we had difficulty recording because we committed the sin of laughing at our own jokes, which is really a bad thing to do, isn't it? I mean, it's amateur and schoolboyish. But there was one that we could never say straight off without corpsing. And in fact, it had to be edited to take out all the muffled squeaks. And it was, the first time I used it, it was Dennis showed me a set of very ancient postcards of the Grand Fen area. Some delighted company had thought that they could sell postcards. So, and we were going through them, and one of them was this chapel, and I said to Pete, wasn't I don't remember seeing this chapel at Grand Fen. Dennis would say, the house chapel, of perpetual endurance and yeah. everlasting, on and on and on. There were about 10 words. You know?
Yeah.
And I said, oh, really? Yeah. And what happened? That fell down. another one we had was, and that took about 10 minutes. I don't know whether, Carol, were you ever there when we had to record that one?
Oh, yes.
You were, yeah. Yes. And it really did take ages.
I did have postcards of it.
Oh, yes, there was a photograph of the Chapel of Everlasting, what's it? Another thing one we had was that we had an idea that the post office and Grand Fen wanted to attract new business. And it also had a lot of things it was desperately trying to get rid of, because Miss Edwards, who ran the post office, was half in love with a salesman with brill cream hair, who she thought was very attractive, and he used to unload all sorts of his rubbish. Her shed behind the shop was full of all the stuff that she had never shifted. Enamel sink tidies, millions of them. The advertisement, I'll try to cut it short, there was a script for this advertisement for the shop, and there was a conversation between Miss Edwards and me as a tourist, and I am supposed to go into the shop and say, have you any folding safari dinner gongs? to which Miss Edwards replied, what size? No, that took us ages. So you can imagine, I coughed before we finished the question. What size? Yeah, we did quite a lot of laughing at our own jokes. But it is bad. Any more questions? It might jog me into something else. Am I going on too long?
Chris? Well, I can't remember any of the your third parties in adults actually having a speaking part.
Never.
It was just the two of you, wasn't it?
Yeah, the only... Well, Mrs. Jeffries once was audible, but it was only when her horrible high-heeled shoes clicked across the chancel in the church, because she wasn't arranging the flowers, she was deranging other people's flowers, so hers looked better. And so you heard Mrs. Jeffries walking across there. I can't remember any time when otherwise. No, I don't think... You're Miss Edwards. We call her Miss Edwards.
We did a Christmas broadcast. It was when, at some point during its life, we had to make, instead of making one episode, we had to make two episodes, because it was Radio Grunty Fen.
Oh, yes.
And so we made two episodes, and we had a Christmas episode. And Gran used to support this African tribe.
The Mandy Mandy Banders.
Yeah. And Chris had written this script for Gran's broadcast. Christmas broadcast,
oh, yes.
The Queen's Christmas broadcast, to the Mandy Bandit. But what Radio Grunty Fen did was they broadcast this in English, in Welsh, in Polish.
And Mandy Bandit.
And Mandy Bandit. And we had Ray Daniels, who used to work at Radio Grunty Fen. He did the Welsh version, they translated to him. Sophie Rowell, who used to work there,
did the Polish.
She did the Polish one. And I had to do the Mamba Bamboo. So I had to pretend to be a
Mamba Bamboo. That's right, yeah.
Absolute rubbish. Doing it all in Mamba Bamboo, which is just his made up language.
And do you remember the Mamba Bamboos? Oh God, this gets more and more complicated. The Mamba Bamboos in Africa had a missionary there called Mr. Fuller Love, the Reverend Fuller Love, and he used to send photographs back sometimes to Granny because she used to raise money for the missions to the Matabandis. And Mr. South is looking at the photographs over the years of the Reverend Fuller Love with the Matabandis and notices that he keeps losing limbs. He loses a leg in one, and then he loses an arm in another. And this is because the Matabandis were cannibals. And they were slowly eating their way through the well, that was all taken as to sort of thing. It does happen. So,
do you think you get away with some of these jokes today?
That's a very interesting question. I would think not. I had the most enormous row with the BBC over not over Dennis, but over something else, which I thought was perfectly all right. But it was not woke. Yeah. You know? Yeah. Fortunately, I think woke is on the way out. I think it's become so preposterous that people are now afraid to talk to one another. Yeah. But the answer is, I think, no. Because I don't think nothing like stuffing from a poop to get to Pakistan would now. No complaints from the public at all. And they weren't so stupid they didn't see the double meaning. Well, you did, didn't you? Didn't you?
Yes!
I don't think. And of course, it's more insidious than that. It is the fear that it might offend that stops you even taking a chance, so that inventiveness is trapped in and closed in on. Sometimes the complaints that filter through to me, not through Dennis, didn't come from any specific person. Just a feeling, you know. Oh, for God's sake. I really got exasperated. But I've got no time for the BBC these days at all. I really haven't. I think it's just fallen to pieces. And Carol will, I'm sure, agree with me that the BBC totally failed to see what they'd got at Dennis. They could have exploited it much more wisely because it really did happen. If it lasts for 17 years... I mean, it can't be a complete waste of time and unfunded, can it? To give you an illustration of the ludicrous intervention of the BBC, one of the few, and possibly the only intervention from a station manager was when he said he wanted to talk to me about Dennis Granny Fenn. Yes, so we had a solemn conversation about it. And she had then been running for 10 or 12 years. And he wanted to change the name to Dennis at Granty Fen instead of Dennis of Granty Fen. Now, if that is the only comment you can offer after all those years, then you're in the wrong business. You really are. And I just despaired of them. I really did. I still do. I have a very low opinion of not the individuals. They are good people trapped in an insipid, half-hearted, lackluster frame of mind imposed from above. And nobody is... Do you know, I used to say, what is the worst word you can use if you work for the BBC? What is the worst thing you can do if you work for the BBC? The worst word is enthusiasm, and the worst thing you can do is show enthusiasm, because they're really afraid of that. They can't. They're so empty-headed themselves. Oh, I shouldn't be saying that. but they're so empty-headed that they see enthusiasm as a threat. You're after their job, you know? You know, you really love doing this. No, that's uncontrollable. People who love doing it. No, we want people who are a bit sort of half-hearted, and we can run them. Then this at instead of off. Oh, sorry, it was...
No, that's all right. My apologies, I've never listened to any of the broadcasts, but have you ever done them to a live audience? And if so,
for a live audience?
Yeah, if so, did it make any difference?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't think we ever
did.
We did appear on stage together. And of course, after his death, I did a big thing on stage, but not on stage, but yes, we did appear together a lot at things like agricultural shows and that sort of thing.
Yeah,
right. But that's not quite the same as doing the act, is it?
Yeah.
No. No, that reminded me of something else, and it floated away again immediately. But, it'll come back if somebody else will ask it. Am I going on too long?
No. How did you pick Grumpy Finn?
Do you know, it was a man who became quite unpopular, Clement Freud, who I got to know really well. And in fact, he recommended me for the running Desert Island Discs when it was up for grabs. He had a high opinion of me. When he was MP for Ely, he was delighted to discover that he was MP for Grunty Fenner. He couldn't believe, you know, this awful place. And that's where Grunty Fenner came from. It was, well, I'm not certain I've got that right, because I think Pete was using Grunty Fenner. I can't remember. I really can't remember. But it was extraordinary.
Didn't he ask a question?
He did, you're quite right. Yes. What do the people of Grundy Fen going to think about this? They're quite right, that was it. Yeah.
I think it was kind of satiry.
Yeah, it was in Hansard, I remember finding it. Yeah. But you know, all those years of. I was dimly aware that there really was a place called Grundy Fen, but I never went there. And because I was afraid that, you know, I mean, it must have reduced the value of their houses. I thought that must be the end of
it.
So say that again.
Which is over the 810 from Grand Ten.
Ah.
My dad used to do all the time when I was young.
Well, I thought that they must be cross with us and in despair.
We love it.
Oh, yeah, this is what I found out. And in the end, I ventured there to do a programme about the real Grunty Fen. And I thought nobody's going to let me in the houses. And they all said, come in. Oh, that's great. And all my fears were completely wrong. There was a very sad one. Grunty Fen had a tennis club, presided over by Bunty. Anybody remember her? No, the secretary of Grunty Fen tennis club was Bunty something, and she was very keen. And Grunty Fen had a sort of a clubhouse, which was an old caravan. And it had a trophy cabinet, which was a cold meat cabinet from the co-op. And it had everything. Grunty Fen Tennis Club had everything except a tennis court. They had been given a bit of land. A farmer had given the tennis club a bit of spare land to make their tennis court on. But it turned out to be very hard to get a surface of grass or hard, because the more hardcore you threw on, it just sank in. And so it was a quaking fen, this bit of lid. I mean, typical farmer. he gave them a bit of land that was completely useless. So Grunty Fen was last heard of. The tennis club hadn't played tennis, but otherwise they were having a lovely time. Those businesses of the vanishing villages. Of course, we still, there's a you can buy a copy if you wish. There's a map of the Grande Fermé area, but it's out of date because they keep finding new villages that nobody has suspected were there. Because, I mean, it was years before, well, actually some villages sprang into being, like Bottle Bank, but that was only started, it's quite a big village now, but that only started when the council put a row of things for recycling metal and bottle and things. And as soon as people put anything into these skips, people from the family would arrive and take it out. So it was that the closer you were to the skips, the more likely you were to get the good stuff. So people started to make houses around. And that's how the village existed. I just thought it was something else. There was a resort. There was people used to go to an inland resort. And I can remember one of the things that, to entertain visitors was the world's biggest collection of salad cream bottles. But also on offer was a Judy show. And Mr. South says, so Dennis says, well, yeah, you can go to the Judy show. I said, don't you mean a Punch and Judy show? And he says, yeah, that used to be a Punch and Judy show, but you see, his missus used to use Punch as an oven graph. So he was only left with a Judy. Oh, God. One of the great things is it doesn't really date. I don't think it does. You just have to go into this other world where everything goes wrong, everything is disgusting, everything fails, but everybody's happy. Nobody, I mean, apart from Mrs. Jeffries, everybody's happy. Apart from the vicar, who has a terrible time. I mustn't get carried away again. You know why they can't ring the bells? Because the town might fall down.
What was the origin of your rhubarb festival?
Rhubarb, yeah. Well, there's a whole culture of rhubarb, of course, at Grande Fermé. It goes back millennia. In fact, those bog oaks, you know, they're in fact partly fossilised rhubarb. Because there used to be, in time immoral, there used to be great forests of rhubarb out on the fens. One of the reasons the dinosaurs died out, because they used to go straight through them. And they... And more recently, rhubarb is a very important crop in the area. In fact, there used to be, the Fens used to export rhubarb to the Empire. They used to dry it and put it in bales and send it on barges around to the whole Empire. And then next to the dried rhubarb factory was a custard factory. And one day there was an explosion. The steam engines that ran the rhubarb and the custard factories exploded, and there were great blobs of custard scattered miles and miles over the fence, and people came from Cambridge with buckets. So rhubarb plays a huge role. In fact, there's a Dennis song about rhubarb. That's what keeps the British Army regular. One of the things, before mobile phones, we've never really reached. You know, the technology is very slow to reach Grande Fermé. And sometimes it comes in the wrong order. Like the tea cosy arrived in Grand Defen before the teapot. And at first people thought it was something to do with family planning. And then the pencil sharpener arrived before the pencil, which is ridiculous. Before the mobile phone, and I think they still use it, there was a system of signalling over the great flat areas of the fen, so that a man out in the fields could tell his wife he'd be home for lunch at a certain time. And this was rhubarb semaphore. And you have two huge rhubarb bits, and you write some messages. And there were special short ways of doing it, you know. It was a bit embarrassing, though, because everybody knew what you were saying to the missus, so it was a bit difficult. Oh, God, I've gone ranting off again. Any more questions? Ask me a question, otherwise I'll go on forever.
Well, the tapes are not wonderful. I've got one or two at home. And the one I like most is the Tale of St. Peter's Eye.
Say it again?
The Tale of St. Peter's Eye. The sparrow that flies through.
Do you know, I forget, I wrote them and I forget them. What, St. Peter's Eye?
Yeah. It was in the church and the eye of St. Peter's bit of glass is missing.
Oh! Yes. And the organ that couldn't the church organ that kind of thing can't be used during the owl nesting season. Because it would disturb the owls too much. And the apse, in fact, the church is mostly a converted mission hut, and it lies on its side, so you get a sort of apse. But it's got stained glass windows, which, if you look closely, you can see that it, an advertisement for Viral or the Ovaltine girl. You know, it's all been taken from shops advertisements and used very cleverly to make stained. And if you listen closely at the font, you can hear the fen underneath sucking, because the fen is always trying to suck you in. In quite recent years, it sucked in a whole estate of bungalows. They all just vanished overnight. And on the floor of Grand Defen Church, this is why I think the church got a bit upset with us, because we didn't take it seriously enough. I think it made the church more relaxed music, but still. There is a brass which the ladies of Grand Defen pay particular attention to clean, because it's part of some sort of a fertility cult. The brass is a nobleman's grave, but you can't read his name because the women have rubbed it with polish so much that it's right. So he's just known as Sir Hugo de Wasbane. What's his name? And they sacrifice shrews on the surface as part. Oh, I just. It just goes on and on and on. Yeah. I bet you really want me to shut up now. Any more questions before I die? Have I gone on long enough? Have I gone on too long?
No, you're just about right, Chris.
Ah.
It's a real interesting.
There's a gentleman at the back there.
Christopher, do any of the
spades,
teams of spam still survive within the pillbox?
Ah, God, that was a very important, the spam. Do you know, oh, I think that's tell you something. But yeah, after the war, these concrete pillboxes were left all over the fen, and in some of them had been secreted supplies of spam in tins left behind by the Americans during the war. And some of it was, well, it was, there were two sorts of spam in different pillboxes, but the very best was the 44. The 1944 spam was much better than the 45 spam. And the only problem was that, and it, the particular pillbox where the 44th band was a secret, and Dennis knew where it was, and he was going to take me there, which he did. But we had to be very careful not to raise our voices or move suddenly or make any noise, because the tins were in a very critical state. And if you disturb them, they exploded. And then you got spam all over you. And we made a recording of me visiting the spam pillbox. And we, at that stage, this was quite early days, we were so naive that we thought that the best way to make a recording to get the acoustic of inside a pillbox was to go inside a pillbox. That was naive amateur, because places on the radio don't really sound like the places you're trying to be. But nevertheless, we did, and we made a recording of explosions, which we took with us on a tape player into the pillbox. And this is years and years ago. And we discovered later that it was much more sensible, and this is what Carol was so good at, just making the sound effects without actually going there. I remember once I got trapped in a lorry. I was looking for, we wanted to make a recording inside the cab of a lorry. And I thought the place to do that would be inside the cab of a lorry. This is ridiculous. I mean, it's so naive. And I'm ashamed to admit it. And I found a lorry abandoned in a little wood near Sawston. And I thought that might do. So I climbed in and shut the door. And there was no door handle to get out. I was trapped in the cab. And the way I got out was, I'd seen a man at these windscreen replacement shops, what they did. And so I put my 2 feet on the windscreen with my back on the driver's seat and pushed the windscreen out of its rubber sockets and climbed out through the windscreen and crept away. And I went, the owner must have been mystified about what happened to his lorry. But that was before we discovered that the best way, if you want to make the sound effects of a fire crackling, the last thing you want to do is record a fire crackling. What you want to do is get some cellophane or crackling paper, and that sounds more like a fire than a fire. So we used all sorts of, and Carol helped enormously with that. I nearly shut up, didn't I? And I started again.
Well, that's fine. Has anybody got any other comments? Any
other? One quick thing, Chris. Is the exhibition, is it the Burwell Museum on Dennis?
No, that's not there anymore. It's, we had right. Two exhibitions. We had one at Water Beach and
Burwell.
But then Denny added before that.
Denny.
Yeah. And Burwell, and that was quite a big thing we had.
What happened to Margaret Singer? Is she still around?
Yeah, all the stuff. I've still got some of the stuff, but they wanted to use the space for something else, and it ended. But the tricycle is now a historian that I used to work with. He's got that with a trailer.
Yes.
I've still got the trade bike.
Yes.
Which is a lovely one. Mm. And I've still got his coat and his hat and his big drum. You know, we could do that. I always wanted to set up an exhibition in an old railway carriage. That would have been lovely. And there's not so many around there, but there used to be quite a number of old railway carriages that people were living in.
The Grunty Fen doesn't have a plaque up for you then?
No, but they don't. But I mean, the people wouldn't be utterly averse to it. And there's a people who live in the railway station. There's a place next door to it called, it's an old disused railway station. Anyway, there's a family there called Green at that time. And parts of the stories were set in the old railway station, and people used to come out at weekends, drive out, and trying to find the railway carriage and all the places, you know, mentioned, the rubbish dump and so on. And the Greens were very nice. They never said it's all nonsense and this don't be so silly. They said, you keep on up there. So right, go. Okay. All they did was go round in a big circle and come back there. But that was the spirit of the thing, you know, that everybody was desperately trying to believe that it was real, to the extent that it really became real. Sometimes when I'm perplexed, I wish I had the thing. Dennis had a thinking chair. You remember a big tall chair, and it was an old barber's chair, and you could pump it up taller and taller, and then when it was up at its maximum height, you'd have a think. Do you remember the security? Who remembers the security measures? You know, he had lots of sheds, but the biggest shed was the miscellaneous shed. And you remember the security arrangements?
No.
Come on, anybody who lives in security
walls?
Yes! Well done! It was entirely made of doors. So that you never knew which one was the working door. Well done! Very good.
Thank you very much, Mr. South. And thank you also to the organisers and members of War Boys Local History Society. If you'd like Mr. South to come and talk to your group, please do get in touch with us via the website at www.dennisofgruntyfen.co.uk, where you can also learn more about the wonderful and weird world of Dennis of Grunty Fen. So don't forget, that's all in your life.